Thus.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tomorrow is Election Day in Charlotte. If you plan to vote and if you haven't taken advantage of early voting, this hour is for you. We're going to take a look at the candidates and issues in many of the key races, including the Charlotte mayor's race, those for city council and school board, as well as some other issues like the bonds. We're joined by four people who have been following all of this closely. Julie Rose has been doing just that for us. She's a reporter for WFA News. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is longtime Charlotte Observer political reporter Jim Morrill. Good morning to you.
Morning.
And to provide some perspective on all this, we welcome back Dr. Eric Heberlich, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte.
Morning, Mike.
Hello. Weren't you just here last week?
I think I was.
You were. And Lisa Miller will be joining us. She's our education reporter here at WFAE. When we get into the school issues and the school bonds, she will join us. Early voting has been underway for a little while now. I heard this morning that 22,000 people took advantage of early voting. How does that compare to previous elections?
I think that's higher than in the previous two mayoral elections. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think both sides made an effort to get their people out to vote early this time. But I think Democrats still have an advantage. I mean, they have a registration advantage that's 2-1, and I think you saw that advantage played out a little bit in early voting, where more Democrats voted than Republicans.
Do we know anything about the turnout, the makeup of the turnout? Has anybody done any early voting polling? Is that done for an election this size?
I think some Democrats have done it, and I think that what I've read about it is that more women large majority of women made up the voters, and Democrats. And African Americans voted disproportionately.
We went for a very long time with a single mayor, Pat McCrory, who I've forgotten now how many terms he served, but it was a lot.
Like seven, right?
Something like that. And of course, now we're changing mayors like we change our socks, because Mayor Fox has been taken off to Washington to be the Secretary of Transportation, and we have an interim mayor who will not be running again. Have we been grooming a back bench, or did the candidates that we have to choose from this time just appear out of thin air?
Well, they haven't appeared out of thin air. I mean, you know, they've all come through the city council as sort of the path to this particular race. Patrick Cannon probably has had ambitions for this for a long, long time. I mean, he's been in office 20 years. He was first elected at 26. That is his – he has been a politician most of his adult life. So certainly he is well known to the community. And as an at-large candidate, and at least in this last election, the largest vote getter among the at-large candidates, he's been mayor pro tem, so certainly visible. And Edwin Peacock, while he only served for two terms in the as a Republican on the city council, he was the last Republican to hold a citywide office until losing that
citywide
seat.
Because he was an at-large.
He was an at-large, exactly. And, you know, I mean, his name is known because he's named after his father, who was Ed Peacock, who was a long, long, long time servant in the city county commission both, and then also ran for mayor against Harvey Gantt. So
the job of mayor in Charlotte really doesn't have any real power. I think you vote to break ties on the city council, and you're kind of a point person. You're the person who sets an agenda or tries to set an agenda and point the way toward that agenda. But the role of mayor has led to bigger things for people who have held it recently, like Sue Myrick, who went to Congress for many years, Pat McCrory, who's the governor, Anthony Fox, Secretary of Transportation. What exactly does the Charlotte mayor do that would lead to positions like that?
Well, it's really serving as the face of the city. You're the spokesperson. You go to a lot of community meetings. You go to business meetings trying to recruit companies to come to Charlotte. So that provides you the ability to have a stepping stone, that you're really out there meeting with people, doing a lot of city business, even though it's not political power per se that you have. You don't control the jobs. You don't control the money. But you do have the ability to meet people and set the message for the city.
Sure, be the face and also those relationships. I mean, the mayor's job is relationships, and politics is about relationships, and it's about who can raise the money. And if you've been out there, a face, a relationship, I mean, you look at the people who gave to Pat McCrory, it's a lot of people who benefited during his time as mayor, and, you know, businesses, whoever you build your relationships with, look at Mayor Fox and all the time he spent cultivating those relationships with the Obama administration and with the DNC. You know, I mean, that's where the stepping stone really lies.
And not only that, but I mean, you have to look at the Charlotte media market. I mean, a Charlotte mayor is automatically known in a multiple county area around Charlotte. And so when Pat McCrory runs for governor, he's already got a statewide base or part of a statewide base.
So how would you classify this, the importance of this vote and the outcome of it? Does it make a difference whether we vote for Peacock or whether we vote for Cannon or whether we vote for somebody else? In the end, does it make a difference?
Yes, but not a huge amount to city policy, because city policy is really set by the rest of the city council and administered by the city manager. Mm-hmm. But what it does send is a tone. What the mayor says in terms of describing to outsiders what Charlotte is like is important in terms of attracting new residents and businesses.
I think both Peacock and Cannon would like us to believe that they. That they could make a nicer city, a nicer experience, just in terms of the political. I mean, one thing that they believe the mayor can do is sort of set the tone for how the council works together, how they tackle big, difficult issues. Both of them feel like that was lacking in the bickering that we've seen in city council over the streetcar and over the proposed tax increase in the last cycle, and that they feel like they could do better than Mayor Fox did in that. So, you know, it's sort of like it's the uncle that kind of, you know, sits at the dais and breaks a tie when necessary, but ideally, they say, you know, behind the scenes is developing relationships that can help make for maybe a less angry environment.
In Edwin Peacock, you have a man who comes from a political background. His father was in politics. He's relatively upper middle class upbringing. Patrick Cannon, raised in public housing, who worked himself up through building a very successful business and being on city council, lives in Ballantyne. Those are the differences. What are the similarities?
Both of them like to talk about being servant leaders. They both have sort of come from a perspective where they feel like, you know, it's not so much about them and the flash as it is about being a servant in the community. So, I mean, I think that Peacock couches himself as a moderate, which he has to do in order to get enough votes to win as a Republican in this city. Cannon has not been a flashy servant in you know, city council. There are a few things that he can hang his hat on, but he has not been, you know, out there stirring things up in a really visible way most of the time. So I think in that way, they've had a little trouble sort of differentiating themselves, I think, to voters.
There are some people who have said, and I think I read this in The Observer, and I think they were proponents of Edwin Peacock, but that in this divisive era in which we live, Peacock is the kind of guy who can bring both sides together. But really, are the sides that far apart locally in the city of Charlotte? Really?
Well, I don't think on the city council they are. I think the fracture that you see on city council is often among Democrats. I mean, Democrats have a 9-2 advantage. Mm-hmm. That's probably not going to change after the election. I think the divisiveness that you see and the bickering all comes between the city and the state and the delegation to Raleigh.
And Patrick Cannon is a business person. He has a parking business. I guess he runs, parking lots all over the city?
Yeah, manages parking lots, right.
Does that give him conservative, at least fiscally conservative leanings? Does that make him attractive to some Republicans because he's in business?
He has, over his career, reached out to business quite a bit and has, I'd say, more business support than many Democrats in Charlotte. So he does make that part of his message, that he's more moderate, more fiscally conservative. So I think, you know, I agree with Julie in that they both position themselves as moderate candidates. Certainly Peacock emphasizes kind of the social issue angle, being more tolerant than some Republican rhetoric is. So again, that makes it harder for voters to differentiate them. We say we like moderate candidates, but then when we get them, we kind of struggle. You know, we don't get too excited about the outcome of the election, and we'll see in terms of turnout.
Well, don't forget that Cannon even broke from Anthony Fox a couple of years ago, famously when he helped reject the capital improvement budget because it included property tax money for a streetcar. And he drew the line there. And so I think that he is more moderate that way.
Peacock served as an at-large councilman from 2007 to 2011. What does his record on council during that period tell us about what kind of mayor he might be or what his approach to issues might be?
Well, I think the issue that he's most connected with is the environment. He chaired the environment committee for the city council. Pat McCrory named him that. He had no prior particular connection with the environment, but he really took it and he ran with it. And he convened some community town meetings where he got ideas from people. Sierra Club supported him. So, you know, he took that and he
made some policy out of it. The tree ordinance was sort of the big policy that he is real proud of on that front.
The issues in this race seem to have centered around the semi-controversial capital improvement plan, which was passed under Mayor Fox, the streetcar, control of the airport. Are there other issues that we need to think about when we go into the voting booth tomorrow?
The Panthers came up, but I think that's part of the more general issue of, you know, how do we spend city dollars on economic development? Mm-hmm. How much do we chase after the big name corporations versus how much do we just kind of have basic services for everybody and let growth come as it does?
When you look at what the city council spends its time on, you look at those agendas, it's going to be it's zoning, which oftentimes that has nothing to do with party affiliation and a lot more to do with sort of who's in what neighborhood and what, you know, that really tends not to be partisan at all. And then they're dealing with – they're always approving airport spending, at least for now, the way things are structured. So that's a big part of what they do, at least in terms of what they're approving on their consent agenda. And then, there's some public safety and some environment-related stuff that they're dealing with in their committees. But really, I mean, and then investment in roads and sewer.
If this has nothing to do with this program, I'm just curious about this. Maybe one of you knows the answer. If the airport authority takes over control from the city, who approves airport spending going forward?
The airport commission. It would not be an authority. It would be this 13-board commission. And they
would
be approving the spending.
From?
From the airport's spending. The airport's own. Okay. The airport is totally self-funded currently.
In terms of the capital improvement plan, which has been a subject of conversation in this election season, it included a tax increase to support $816 million in improvements. Patrick Cannon ultimately supported the plan, but only after a year of wrangling in which the streetcar was removed, the funding for the streetcar was removed from the tax stream. Mm-hmm. Edwin Peacock has talked about this in his commercials. Where does he come down on the capital improvement plan?
Peacock did not support. He talks about how he didn't think it was the right time. In fact, we even have some sound we can use on this later in the program. But he talks about how he would not have supported it. First of all, the streetcar, he says, I'm supportive of transit, but we should have a transit program that is conducted by the Metropolitan Transit Commission. It shouldn't be something the city's going rogue on to do its own streetcar. That was done the wrong way, he says. But furthermore, the capital improvement plan, he felt like just the size of it is the most problematic thing, that it was, you know, it was almost $900 million, that was unnecessary. We're in a tough time. People are still recovering. The economy is still fragile. We should not be boosting property taxes by 3 cents per $100.
And why did Patrick Cannon support it?
He supported it because he calls it an investment. He and other supporters of it, people who voted, talk about 18,000 jobs. I guess that's over many years, but that would come about. It's investment in streets and sidewalks and police and different parts of town. And so he said that's what we have to do, especially since we can't annex anymore. We can't grow our tax base through annexation. We have to make investments to entice people to come live here.
Cannon also supported a proposal to fund the Uptown Baseball Stadium, but only after the city's contribution was reduced from $11 to $8 million, which doesn't seem like a lot, but a big difference. And no property taxes were involved in that. Again, very quickly, what has Edwin Peacock said about this?
He's saying, I mean, generally speaking, his thinking is, I'm trying to remember if I've actually asked him what he wasn't on council during the final vote of the stadium.
Let me give you a chance to think about it because we have to go to a break and we'll come back and get the answer to that question. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fox 46 Carolinas, presenting the two-hour series premiere of Almost Human, Sunday, November 17th at 8 p.m. Details at myfoxcarolinas.com. And Theater Charlotte presenting Arsenic and Old Lace, a classic comedy about drama critic, the true love he might marry, and his crazy family. Now through November 10th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Billy Graham is one of the world's most famous and influential religious leaders. He grew up right here in Charlotte. He was born 95 years ago this Thursday, and in advance of that, We're talking to former Charlotte Observer religion writer Ken Garfield about his new book, which is a book of pictures talking about the influence of Billy Graham. And then we'll also speak with Davidson College's Dr. Anne Blue Wills about her new book, which looks at Billy Graham's wife, Ruth. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the White House says President Obama was not aware the NSA was spying on European leaders, and he did not know about the problems facing healthcare.gov. Analysis of the president's leadership and management style.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Julie Rose from WFAE News, Jim Morrill with the Charlotte Observer, and Dr. Eric Heberlich, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. I asked a question about the baseball stadium and the funding for the stadium. Patrick Cannon supported that after the money was cut back a little bit, and I asked about where Edwin Peacock came down. This week kind of went batted it around off the air, and we've elected Dr. Heberlich to give us the answer.
Well, I don't know the answer to that one specifically, but I think the larger point is that Peacock has voted for spending like this in the past, has said in his campaign that he supports some types of this spending, but not other types. So he hasn't given us any clear roadmap in terms of his thinking, in terms of what type of capital spending is good, what type of capital spending is bad. So at this point, you know, he's kind of being strategically vague in coming out against spending items that seem to be unpopular and for spending items that people like.
Yeah. Well, he voted for a couple capital improvement budgets, but they didn't include tax increases. Mm-hmm. This last time was the first tax increase in years and years here. Mm-hmm. And he has said he supported some incentives, but not all of them.
Yeah. And when it comes to the Panthers Stadium, which is, I guess, another analogous you know, situation where the city is putting money into, and in this case, again, it's tourism dollars, you know, from other sources going into a private enterprise, he has said you know, he really focuses more on the way the decision was arrived at. You know, he says we have many, many options we could have done. You could have put it to a referendum, let the voter have open meetings, have public meetings, don't do it all in closed negotiations. So, you know, he really has more of a he's been as specific as he's been is really more on the mm-hmm. way it was conducted.
Yeah. Well, here's what some of what Edwin Peacock has said in the past about the capital improvement plan.
When you talk about putting a bold and aggressive capital plan at the edge of a botched county property tax reval married with a very fragile economy, I just don't see the timing as being right.
And here's what Patrick Cannon has had to say about it.
Largely in part because Charlotte's not shrinking, we're growing. And you have to have leadership that will invest in Charlotte's future. And that's where I am today. See.
So Patrick Cannon has also been a big streetcar supporter, and Peacock has called it a shell game being allowed to leapfrog regional transportation priorities, and he sees limited ridership on the line. Now, given that construction is underway, they've got every street downtown torn up, will this project go forward no matter who wins this mayoral contest, or could the outcome of the race have an impact on it?
I think that it's not the mayoral race that matters here. It's the council races that matter here.
Okay.
Because the streetcar itself and really, whether it goes anywhere beyond the mile and a half is happening. Those roads are torn up. It is going in. The funding is there. Where the money comes from to maintain it is we're going to have to come up with that money somewhere, and it's going to come out of the city budget. That's going to continue to be a bone of contention for council members. Mm-hmm. But if it's going to go any further, one way or the other across, you know, out east or west through Charlotte, it's really going to be a matter of the federal government getting grants at this point from the federal government.
Why is this such a hard sell, given the success of the Lynx Blue Line and the fact that we're now going to build it out to the university? And when we do, we are certain, almost certain, to see the same kind of transformation of an area that we've witnessed in South End.
Well, for one thing, it's a streetcar. It's not a light rail line.
So what's the difference? It's a fixed vehicle transportation device that goes on a track.
Stops at streetlights.
Right. There's a lot of skeptics who don't think it's going to bring the impact, even though I guess there are some studies that Anthony Fox and others pointed to that said it would.
Mm-hmm.
People question whether a streetcar would have the same impact as that and whether it would bring the development. And also,
Well, it's not going. When you put a track down the middle of the street, you know you're not going to, in 3 years, decide, well, that's not working. We're going to move the track two blocks to the west.
Clearly, it's more effective than a regular bus route in terms of getting any kind of private investment along that line. I think one thing though that's lost on people is the way the city has done the streetcar is completely circumvented the process that was established a decade ago, I think, regarding transit in the city, in the region. You know, we passed this transit sales tax. They created the Metropolitan Transit Commission, which is this regional body that includes the mayor of Charlotte and others from the region who make decisions about the transit plan, transit funding. They prioritize. The Blue Line came through that process. The streetcar, the city has taken it on its own, sidestep. It wasn't high enough up in the Metropolitan Transit Commission's priorities. Mm-hmm. Mayor Fox wanted that thing, and we sidestepped that process. And as a result, the city is taking all – plus, there's no more transit sales tax money available because it's all being eaten up by the Blue Line and then some. And so – you know, so now basically one of the things that's really, I think, difficult for the city council, many council members, is that the city's trying to take that all on, and there's just not an obvious source of funding for it, both to build it and then to maintain it down the line.
We do have this Democratic majority on city council, and Charlotte has been described as a blue dot in the sea of red. Is Charlotte, because the city takes so much of the county's territory, is the city really blue or is it purple?
We'll find out on Tuesday.
Okay.
Well, but certainly in the past decade, we've seen a pretty dramatic shift in the blue direction. The city was pretty competitive a decade, 12 years ago.
And it's said that Edwin Peacock needs support from independent voters if he wants to win, because the number of independent voters outranks the number of Republican voters. But can Cannon win with Democrats alone, or does he also need independent voters?
Well, there are many independents who call themselves independents but really just support one party or the other. Mm-hmm. So if Cannon basically gets the traditional Democratic vote, including some independents, he wins. What Cannon needs to do is hold all the Republican votes and peel off some traditional Democratic leaning votes.
I just have to say too that we're down basically to two safe Republican seats on the city council, but there is one that could kind of be interesting to watch, a really non-traditional race we have going on up here in the university area, that for the 4th district, that Michael Barnes is running for at large. He did very well in the primary for at large, and that leaves this one seat where we have a really interesting candidate who, Michael Zhitkov, who is an independent, who had to collect 3,000 some signatures in order to get on the ballot. So
and
he's touched a lot of people. I mean, that hadn't been done in a city race before.
Democrat Greg Phipps is a retired bank examiner, and Michael
Zhitkov.
He was a guest on this program.
Yeah,
is the ex officio spokesperson for the Charlotte Occupy movement.
Right. He's now kind of a community organizer. But what I do think is kind of interesting, and I'll just be curious to see, is that, I mean, he has spent months and months and months just getting those signatures, talking to a lot of people on a lot of street corners in this district for months and months and months before we even knew who was running against him. So,
but you know what he's up against, aside from being the first independent to get on the ballot and all that, a lot of Democrats are going to vote straight Democratic tickets. You know, and Greg Phipps may be running a great campaign here in District 4, but he's going to benefit from that.
Yep.
Let's touch on one final time on the mayor's race, and I want to talk about the tepid endorsement that the Charlotte Observer gave to Edwin Peacock. Does that mean that all the rumors about the Charlotte Observer being a liberal rag are untrue, that you would endorse a Republican for mayor?
I've got nothing to do with that.
I know. You're not on the editorial. Does a newspaper's endorsement...
See, he won't even deny it.
Does a newspaper's endorsement mean anything?
I would have to think it does among some people. Among some independents, probably. People who don't necessarily have their minds made up.
And remind us why the Observer endorsed Edwin Peacock over Patrick Cannon.
Well, again, I don't speak for the editorial page, but I think that they just said they liked him better.
Well, maybe you can explain this to me. On one day, the Observer tepidly endorses Edwin Peacock for mayor, and the very next day, Kevin Sires, your political cartoonist, draws a cartoon with a couple looking into a pet store window with a sign saying "Moderate Republicans" over the pet store window and a cute little puppy who looks like Peacock in the window. And the couple says, "Sure, it's cute and cuddly now, but what about when it gets older?" And they are standing there with another big dog on a leash who looks exactly like Pat McCrory. Implication being that moderate Republicans grow into something we don't bargain for. Why the tepid endorsement one day and this cartoon that says beware the very next day?
I can't speak to that, but I can speak to
what
the,
can you speak to?
I think that Edwin Peacock's problems are not only the Democratic registration in the city, but the Republican brand in this city at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans have taken it on they've taken a hit with the recent closure, government shutdown. But more importantly, I think there's a bad feeling among a lot of people in Charlotte, and a lot of those are independent voters, about what happened in Raleigh this year with the airport and with a number of other issues. And Pat McCrory, whether he likes it or not, is the point person on that. In fact, I talked to Peacock about this last week, and he called we were talking about the weight of the Republican on his campaign. He called McCrory the tip of the spear on this. People look at McCrory and make a decision on the Peacock race.
Except for the fact that the governor, once again, like the mayor, has less power than one would presume. It is Tom Tillis, the Speaker of the House, who has more power really than the governor, doesn't he?
The governor signed almost every bill.
Well, yeah, but he's not shaping policy. The legislature is.
The governor didn't speak out much about the airport, which was a big deal down here.
There are – and let's talk about the airport very quickly before we move on to city council. Is there some idea that a Republican mayor in Charlotte could salve over some of the problems with the airport controversy, which was driven by Republicans in the legislature?
Well, so Peacock argues. I think he argues that he would be better than Cannon at dealing with the legislature because they are Republicans.
But I don't think that he or anyone believes that at this point there's something to do to fix the airport. It's in the
courts.
Too late. It's in the courts. That has already left the barn. And, maybe avert future takeover of other things, maybe. I mean, certainly it's funny because, on the one hand, you've got Cannon saying, well, look, the last thing we need is a Republican, in cahoots with what they're doing out in Raleigh. And then you have Peacock saying, clearly we need to have better relationships here. And so that's where I come in.
All right. City Council. There are races for City Council. We need to talk about recent forum among eight candidates. Jim, you reported there appeared to be little support for a streetcar, grudging support for business incentives, and resentment over the state's efforts to transfer control of the airport. What does that portend for the positions that might be taken by the next City Council, no matter who wins these races?
Well, let's talk about the streetcar part. The only Democrat who was against the streetcar was Claire Fallon, who's been against it before. And, unless something significant happens, at least three Democrats are going to get elected, and those are probably going to be the people who support the streetcar. So in that sense, I don't think it makes any difference. I think people are just wanting, transparency in some of these decisions about incentives. And, I think the new city council will look a lot like the old city council.
Michael Barnes, David Howard, Claire Fallon, and Vi Alexander Lyles are the Democrats running. All except Lyles are incumbents. Libertarian Eric Cable is running, as are Republicans Mark Freech, Dennis Peterson, and Ken Harris. Did I leave anybody out?
Vanessa Fora.
Okay. And where is she running? What district?
Republican at large.
At large.
How many seats are open?
Four.
Okay. Given the presence of so many Democratic incumbents, you're saying that we'll probably have the same makeup of the council when this race is over.
Yeah. If you look at look at the financial reports too. I mean, all the Democrats raised a lot more money than the Republicans. A couple of the Democrats raised well over $100,000.
And yet, in the mayor's race, Edwin Peacock outraised Patrick Cannon. Why?
He has more connections to the business community and has a chance at winning, I would say, for the Republicans running citywide. I think that's an indicator that even the donor community doesn't give him much chance.
Hmm. Talk a minute about Claire Fallon. She's probably the most outspoken person on city council and among the candidates, at least. And she has said that the NASCAR Hall of Fame would be better used as a homeless shelter. And she couldn't see moving the losing Charlotte Knights team 20 miles from Fort Mill to Charlotte just so they could lose here. Now, she's 78. She's from the North. She's running for a second term. Some consider her abrasive. Others look at her and find her a breath of fresh air. How will voters see her? How do they see her? Does anybody know?
It's going to be interesting. I mean, I think that she'll get as many Republican votes as Democratic votes. I think Democrats are kind of split on her. But, you know, with those kind of positions, I think she appeals, you know, across the aisle.
She's really, I mean, covering city council this last 2 years, she's kind of a wild card. I mean, you never really quite know where she's going to come down on something. You know, on the one hand, she can be all for incentives for certain businesses or certain kinds of businesses. And then all of a sudden, you know, she's completely not for other types of incentives. You know, she was supportive of the Panthers. You know, they make sense to her, and I'm sure they resonate for a lot of people. But there's not, you know, you can't say, well, she's going to be consistent this way or that way. And I think that makes the Democratic majority very nervous on the council because she can't be counted on to always go along with them. But she's a breath of fresh air for a lot of voters, I think, too, that did say, you know, finally somebody's speaking something that I understand. So,
well, you don't hear a lot. She's not really speaking political speak. She's speaking what she's thinking, and right. That's you don't hear that very often.
Yeah, she's not coming out of the Democratic Party organization. She's never raised much money. So she doesn't owe that type of loyalty to the party. So I think if we were kind of gauging of the four Democrats who might be at most risk, you'd have to say her because of her lack of fundraising. But as Jim pointed out, she probably has the better chance of pulling a lot of independent and Republican support. So the challenge for Republicans is, well, if we throw Claire Fallon some votes, what they're probably doing is helping elect her and blocking any chance of any Republicans winning a seat on city council.
Mm-hmm. Ken Harris is
or the at-large seats.
Right.
Ken Harris is a Republican running for the first time. His father was the city's first Republican mayor in 1977. Is Harris Boulevard named after him? Is that where we get the name?
No.
No? Okay.
It goes back further, I think.
He says he wants to end the bickering and that a smooth, functioning local government will be assigned to companies that Charlotte is a good place to do business. There are echoes of Edwin Peacock's statements in that phrase. But aside from the disagreement between city and state over control of the airport, really a lot of bickering? Is there really a lot of bickering? It seems do I just not follow this?
Well, again, I go back to the bickering was among the Democrats.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
Back when the Democratic majority rejected Anthony Fox's capital budget a couple of years ago.
Which of these races, because there are at-large races on city council and there are district races on city council, of the at-large races, which is the most interesting to you?
Well, I think it's a race for the fourth seat. I think that three of the Democrats, the two incumbents and Lyles, will probably win, given the support they showed in the primary and otherwise. And then I think it's who will get the fourth seat, whether a Republican will crack the winning column for that.
And what about the district races? Are we likely to see any surprises in the outcome of those races?
No. I mean, those aren't really – those are kind of foregone conclusions.
I mean, the only ones that are open are the two Republican seats because Doolin and Cooksey are not running, and they're both going to go to the Republican. So
those were decided in the primary.
Yeah. I mean, there's just that one, like we mentioned, District 4, right. Democrats have, but –
Jim Morrill has to leave us to go on to a reporting assignment. I want to thank you for being here this morning. I appreciate it. When we come back, we'll be joined by Lisa Miller, our education reporter, and we'll look into the school board races and some other educational aspects of all this, like the bonds. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Jim Brickman, the Love Tour, award-winning pianist and recording artist, dazzling solo piano and star-studded vocal collaborations, November 19th in Knight Theater. Tickets at 704-372-1000. And Catawba College in Salisbury, serving traditional and adult students since 1851, an education dedicated to personal attention, blending liberal arts with career preparation. Details at Catawba.com. NSA.edu. The White House says President Obama was not aware that the NSA was spying on European leaders, and he did not know about the problems facing healthcare.gov. Diane Rehm and her guests provide analysis of the president's leadership and management style coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to continue our conversation about tomorrow's election with a focus on the bond issues and more in just a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Collins. Join me and the rest of the Charlotte Talk staff this Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. as we celebrate 15 years of Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're recording a special edition of the program in front of a live audience at the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square with best-selling author of the Bones book series, Kathy Reichs. A reception and book signing will follow the show, and you can tour our Charlotte Talk Spirit Square studio. Find out more at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you this Wednesday. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the elections tomorrow. In case you haven't voted yet, well, you're not among the 22,000 people who have taken advantage of early voting. We're joined now by Lisa Miller, our education reporter. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Still with us, Julie Rose from WFAE News and Dr. Eric Heberlich, a professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. You know, I think you were here when school board used to be a contentious body to be on, when they were always fighting, and it was always interesting to see what was going to happen next. But things have quieted down lately, and there are five district seats up for grabs on the board. These races, too, I think, have been quiet.
It's been a lot quieter this year. I mean, you talked about kind of those exciting times on the school board, and that was around 2005 or 2006. And, you know, things kind of quieted down after that. But 2 years ago, even, there was a little bit more excitement, I feel like, around school board elections. You just had the superintendent, Peter Gorman, stepping down. You had all the changes around testing that he brought in, increasing the number of tests. So you had a lot of parents closely watching that race. And then you had all the school closings that had happened the year before. So I think the eyes were on that mm-hmm. race like they aren't now.
What seem to be the emerging issues among the school board candidates?
Well, now, so there are a couple interesting races down in District 6. That's South Charlotte. You have a race where it's the incumbent is not running. So you have three people vying for that. You have two people who have listed themselves as Republicans and a listed Democrat. Now, these are supposed to be nonpartisan races. But in that race, what you hear a lot about is reactions to state lawmakers and their decisions now. Of course, this year, there's been a lot of changes. Tenure has been taken away for teachers. The state lawmakers decided not to raise teacher pay this mm-hmm. year, which pretty much for the past 5 years, teacher pay has remained flat except for a 1% pay bump last year. So there's a lot of, you know, changes that are going on state law wise, and you have candidates there reacting to that. You have Paul Bailey, who's been in political circles for a long time there, and he's got the endorsement of a bunch of state lawmakers, and he says, you know, hey, I don't always agree with all these decisions. Many of these decisions I haven't agreed with, but really, I'm the right guy to be in this race because I have relations with those people and I can have some influence over them. And then you have Bolin McClung, who he basically got involved with school stuff when bonds failed in 2005. And he goes to all these meetings. He's also a Republican.
Yeah, he's said to spend more time on school board issues than anyone who's not on the school board.
He does. He spends a lot of time. I see him at almost all the meetings I go to. Mm-hmm. He's real well-versed. And his thing is that, you know, I don't want the endorsement from those candidates. I want to, you know, from the state lawmakers. I want to get in and actually get those state lawmakers out of offices. Now, you know, many of them are his fellow Republicans. He's talking about. And then you have a Democrat who's been pretty low profile. You haven't heard from him too much, Doug Rona, who's also running in that race.
Former teacher.
He's very much against the increase in standardized testing going on, and of course, some of the changes regarding tenure and a lack of an increase in teacher pay, too.
This is supposed to, as you said, these are supposed to be nonpartisan races, but I have seen party affiliation listed for almost every candidate in these races.
Sure.
Why?
Well, because they are registered a certain way. So you do hear that coming into play. But yes, technically, a school board is nonpartisan. But obviously, party affiliation.
How can it really be nonpartisan? Why do we have this little charade going here?
That's a good question. I think when you're looking at the office, people would say, "Hey, we're in it for the what's mm-hmm. best for schools, and that should be a nonpartisan thing." But obviously. There are partisans running. So
throughout the state, teacher pay and testing have become issues. What are the candidates saying about this? Because today is the day of the teacher walk-in as opposed mm-hmm. to walk-out.
Yep.
What are they saying about this?
Well, almost all of them are not happy with many of the decisions state lawmakers have made regarding teachers. Teacher pay, you'll hear I've heard all of them say, hey, we think our teachers need to be paid more and the state needs to ante up for that. We're unhappy with that. Several of them have also been upset with the getting rid of tenure. You also, it's interesting because, 2 years ago, right, you had this increase in standardized testing on a local level, and you had, several board members obviously behind that. But now you have some board members, current board members, Eric Davis, for example, he's kind of rethinking a little bit of this. I mean, he thinks there should be, a good amount of standardized testing because you need accountability in schools, he says. But you hear more sort of skepticism of the rise in standardized testing and as far as the folks who are running against some of these candidates,
In District 1, Rhonda Lennon ran 10 years ago for the first time mm-hmm. as a CMS mom who was frustrated with the slow pace of school construction in the northern suburbs. And that was a major issue back in those times because the northern suburbs in the CMS system felt that they were getting the short end of the stick as all the attention was being paid to the inner city. Now she faces a challenger, Christine Mast, also a CMS mom, who is frustrated with the slow pace sure. of school construction. So talk about that. Has nothing changed?
Well, it's interesting how that goes on in North Mecklenburg mm-hmm. County. I mean, obviously, there was a time, and schools are still, rapidly growing up there. But 2005, you saw the bond referendum fail, and I think to some extent because District 1 felt like they were being slighted with schools.
So does this say anything about Rhonda Lennon's progress or her effectiveness, or is it merely a shift in focus because of the change in superintendents and the recession that slowed growth?
I think she's now part of the board that's making these decisions. Mm-hmm. And she feels like, she said, I wish we had more schools up here. I wish there was more construction. But, we got to get behind this bond. There is bond money up for North Mecklenburg County, a replacement school, adding a few grades onto an elementary school, Davidson. She says, yes, I'd like to see more, but we don't even have the bond capacity, the building capacity. The county is not giving us enough building capacity to really, get everything we need.
Is anybody
Mike, if ahead. I could jump in here, I think it helps to remember the context of Rhonda Lennon's appearance on mm-hmm. the school board, that she ran against Larry Gavireau, who was there for a short time, but he was very ideological, very conservative, had a bomb-throwing, abrasive style. And she ran as a Republican, basically challenging another Republican, saying that I'm conservative, but I'll work with other members of the school board collaboratively, constructively to try to make some changes. Bringing more schools to District 1. And we have seen in the past bonds, mm-hmm. we have seen a number of schools build up there. Now, You know, the controversy then in District 1 is whether the pace of building is sufficient given the growth over there. You know, but that's a kind of a different dynamic than we faced when Ron DeLennon first came onto the school board.
I would say that Larry Gavreau was Tea Party before there was a Tea Party.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Sure.
The CMS District 2 is one of the city's most challenging school districts, and we have a retired lawyer, Thelma Byers Bailey, trying to oust a former CMS teacher and one-term board member, Richard McElrath. Why?
Well, you know, this goes back to the school closings, and her local school was closed as part of that. It was changed into a magnet, I believe. And she says, you know, she went before the board and she felt completely unlistened to. So she said it's time to change that on the board. Now, Richard McElrath wasn't gung-ho on the closings. He voted against several of them, but he did vote to close her school. So that's why she's running. And I should say, back up in North Mecklenburg County District 1, you have Christine Mast, who's running against Rhonda Lennon. And as far as this bond package, she says, you know, scrap it. Don't vote for it. We got to get something better together with more building in our area, and then get that approved in the next couple of years.
Now, in District 4, we have a senior board member, Tom Tate, who is a Democrat, facing a challenge from a woman named Queen Elizabeth Thompson to represent District 4 for the next 4 years. What's the issue there, and what's the likelihood of a change in that seat?
Sure. Well, so Queen Elizabeth Thompson was involved with CMS, I believe, as a counselor. She is, you know, thinks that some of the discipline has to be reexamined for students. But that's been a pretty low key race.
Well, she was fired from CMS and filed several lawsuits against them, right?
I believe so. I mean, so she does have a history with CMS. So
what do you see as the likelihood of a change in that district?
Tom Tate is the longest. He's been on the board the longest. So, I mean, he has a lot of support.
District 5, incumbent and former school board chair Eric Davis faces Edward Donaldson, who wants to split CMS into smaller districts. And if that is your goal, is being on the school board the right race to be in? Wouldn't you be better served running for county commission?
Or state legislature.
Yeah. That's probably the call. But I mean, you hear that echoed a lot. I think the last many years, you know, whether you're up in North Mecklenburg County, obviously that's been something some people up there have been pushing, as well as South Charlotte, the idea partly being that, you know, the rest of the school system seems to take a lot of the money. And
has he gotten traction with that stand?
I don't know how much traction he's gotten, to tell you the truth. I know there are definitely people who see his viewpoint, but I also know that Eric Davis has quite a bit of support in that area too.
What's the most interesting school board race in your view?
I really think it's either District 1 or District 6, North Mecklenburg County or Southern Mecklenburg County, for some of those reasons that we talked about.
Okay. There are also $200 million in CPCC bonds on the ballot to buy land and build classroom space for the Levine campus in Matthews, the central campus downtown, and expansion for other campuses, and a $290 million CMS bond package. I haven't heard a lot of negative talk about either of these bond packages, and we do have a history of passing the bonds, except in that one instance you referred to a few minutes
2005.
Ago. 2005. Is anybody talking about this one way or the other? Are they just going to pass?
I think you do hear some people talking about they should fail, you know, and you hear that mostly, I believe, from people sort of northern Mecklenburg County and southern Mecklenburg County. And you might hear the same, you know, folks saying we need to have more localized districts and you know, break away at some point. You do hear that.
What would CMS be using the $290 million for?
So they would be using it to build three new schools.
Where would they be?
They would be in East Charlotte, West Charlotte, and South Charlotte.
Once again, northern Mecklenburg County gets shafted.
Well, and that's what they're saying. They up in northern Mecklenburg County, they're getting what's called a replacement school. So JM okay. Alexander is an old school. They right. would basically replace that. So that's most of the spending up there. And then it's kind of interesting, too, that you have two schools that were closed a few years ago that are being reopened and repurposed. So you have Starmount Elementary in South Charlotte. It used to be a pre-K center. That's opening up. And then Oakhurst in East Charlotte is opening up as well.
So a quick primer on how these bonds work. They do not raise taxes, correct?
They do not raise taxes in the sense that the county has already figured out the amount of borrowing that it's planning on for the next many years.
Right.
So that is basically worked into the tax rate. Yes, if the county didn't borrow, taxes would be lower.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is now, it's worked in there. So it does not, by approving the bonds, it does not.
And just because we passed $290 million in CMS's case does not mean that they're going to go out the next day if we vote yes and spend the $290 million. This is going to be
exactly.
happening over a long period of
exactly.
time. In fact, they haven't even spent some of the money from previous bonds yet.
Sure. And this coming bond, this bond package basically extends to the last project would be 2020 that's built from 2015 to 2020. And there is no guarantee. I mean, last time around, for example, you had a good size, about $516 million. Mm-hmm. And then you had tough times come in, right? And the county tightened its belt. And basically what that meant is that it put a halt to many of the construction projects that were in that bond.
We're an urban city. You've already talked about this, Eric. And we're a Democratic city in a Republican state. But there's a lot of anger in the electorate about what's going on in Washington. Is that liable to trickle down in any way to this off-year local election?
It could, in the sense that, you know, talking about bonds, if people really are frustrated with spending and government incompetence, that could show up in the bonds, people saying we're not giving any more money. As we heard earlier, if the Republican brand is damaged, that could hurt Peacock and the Republican City Council.
Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, Lisa Miller, our reporter for education here at WFAE. And I want to say thank you and a job well done to Julie Rose. This is her last appearance on this program because she's going off to greener pastures elsewhere for personal reasons. But you have been a truly valuable asset to WFAE and a great co-host for this program on occasion. And we will miss you, and the city owes you a debt of gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.